Next year marks the 50th anniversary of the development of the first supercomputer. Today's supercomputers are much bigger and more powerful than those early models, and one of the biggest of them had its formal launch last month at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. That computer, Blue Waters, is a petascale supercomputer, meaning that it's a machine that can surpass a petaflop in operation or 1 quadrillion floating operations per second. What sort of problems require a computer this powerful? And could we use even more computing power? Today on Focus, we'll be talking with Bill Gropp. He's with the U of I's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies, and he's done a lot of work on Blue Waters. He'll be talking about supercomputers and Blue Waters in particular, what we're using them for, and what sort of difference they can make in our lives. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus with Bill Gropp comes up right after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today, Bill Gropp, works with really big supercomputers, in particular the new Blue Waters supercomputer at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. And Bill is director of the U of I's Parallel Computing Institute, and he's the deputy director for research at the university's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies. And he'll be telling us how these machines work, if not in minute details, at least so that non-computer people can get some idea about them. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And just to set things straight, we were talking about this a little bit before we went on air. Where does Blue Waters rank in terms of computing power? Is it the most powerful supercomputer around, or are the most powerful one at a university or of a certain type? And how do you figure out these things?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, how do you measure the power of a computer? There is a benchmark based on an old operation that used to be important that is used to rank a lot of these computers. And there's a ranking produced twice a year of machines using this. But it's a difficult and expensive test to run, and so we've decided not to bother, not to waste time on it. Still, I can say that if we did bother, we would be, I think, in the top 5 or 6 worldwide for biggest supercomputers. But that's really, I think, not the way to look at it. These machines are designed and built in order to solve big science problems. And when you look at our ability to do big science problems because of some of the other features of the machines that benchmark doesn't test, I think we, in fact, may have the most powerful machine for real science in the world. Certainly, if you look at the computing power that's available for researchers at a university, this is the most powerful machine by any measure available anywhere. The number two machine, in fact, is a IBM BlueJean machine at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia, where they bought the entire supercomputer for their own use.
Okay. So however you measure, it's a pretty powerful machine out there. And we want to welcome you to the conversation as well. Just call with your questions and comments for Bill Gropp at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL or toll-free at 800-222-WYLL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And Bill, let's start at the beginning. And how do we define a supercomputer? What sets a supercomputer technically apart from a computer?
So a supercomputer is really just the biggest, most powerful, baddest machine that you can build at the time. And so right now, it's machines of the computational power, the size of something like Blue Waters. When I was a graduate student, it was a machine that was, again, the most powerful machine you could afford to build. But that machine is, in fact, was slower than my phone is today because of the rapid increase in the ability to compute. Machines become about 1,000 times faster every 10 years. And so the definition can't be it's a machine that's capable of, say, doing a certain number of operations per second. It has to be what's the fastest machine you could build today, and that's a supercomputer.
And it makes you wonder, the way things are going, what will Blue Waters look like in the pantheon of supercomputers 10 years from now?
Oh, in 10 years, it will be will have been a very powerful machine that is now significantly slower than machines that you're likely to see in individual university departments.
That is scary in a way. If you ever, especially, I have not been inside the Blue Waters facility, but it is 188,000 square feet. It's a big building. And you're telling me that might be replaced in a decade by something the size of somebody's desk. A couple of desks.
Yes, yeah, a couple of desks. Could happen. Historically, that has been the way it has gone. A machine that's 1,000 times powerful every 10 years. And that's the way to look at it. You go from, in the case of Blue Waters, we have a little under 300 racks. So a machine 1,000 times faster wouldn't even be a single rack size. So it would be smaller than, say, a washing machine.
Okay. Now I see what we have to look forward to. You're director of the U of I's Parallel Computing Institute, and that's devoted to making, the most parallel computing technologies. What is parallelism, and what does it mean for supercomputers?
So parallelism is simply finding ways to get many people, many devices, to work together to solve the same problem. So if we look at the supercomputers, for a long time, the supercomputer was built by making the fastest processor, just like the kind of processor you now have in your laptop, that would solve a single problem and would be a single working engine that would use a definition of the problem in mathematics to solve the problem. But as we went on, it became more and more difficult to build a single machine that was that fast. And so in order to continue providing more power to solve these problems, we did is we get more people to work on them, or more devices. So this is just like saying you've got a big task, you're organizing a big meeting, and instead of trying to do everything yourself, you divide it up among different of your friends to work on it together, and you have to coordinate. And that's really all that a parallel computer does, is divides up the problem among a number of workers, and they're coordinated so that they work together, and they solve then one problem. What's amazing about parallel computers today is that the number of workers that we're talking about are enormous. So the largest machine currently is the Sequoia machine at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. It has over 1.5 million processing cores.
That's a lot. And how many does Blue Waters have?
So depends on how you count. Blue Waters has somewhere between about 360,000 and 720,000 of the kind of processing cores you might find in your laptop, except each of them is faster than what you would find in your laptop. Plus, Blue Waters has about 3,000 graphical processing units, which can also do the sorts of math computations that you find in applications today. And measuring the number of compute units for that is it's a little different. It's sort of like comparing apples and oranges. But we're looking at somewhere between 400,000 and 800,000 processing elements, all coordinated to work on the same problem.
So a supercomputer might be thought of as sort of a team of computers working together on the same problem.
Exactly. One way I've described this sometimes is if you think of a symphony orchestra as a collection of specialists that are working together to produce something beautiful, symphony music, that are coordinated by the conductor. This is different than having a lot of individual musicians solving individual problems, playing a solo piece. And a big parallel computer has to essentially work as a big symphony orchestra. One of the things that's different is that the coordination requires that each of the individual pieces, each of the individual sort of musicians, knows how to work together, because these machines are so fast that you cannot coordinate them from a central site. And so part of what a computer scientist does is figure out how to design the way we compute so that they can work together to solve one big problem.
So they have to be, the different parts of the supercomputer are like constantly checking on each other, looking at each other's answers and figuring out where they progress to next based on not just what one processor came up with, but what all of them came up with.
That's right. And one of the things that's very important about a big supercomputer is it's not just a collection of processors that compute. A very important part of a big supercomputer or modern supercomputer is what's called the interconnect network, the very pieces of hardware and the related software that allow the processors to talk to each other, to coordinate what they're doing, to share information.
Do supercomputers operate like less powerful computers? I mean, do they have something that you would recognize as an operating system, a supercomputer, Microsoft Windows or Linux?
Yes. In fact, Blue Waters is running Linux.
Really?
A specialized version of SUSE Linux on each of the nodes. Each of the nodes looks very much like a very high-powered desktop system. There have been customizations, again, to make it easier for the nodes to talk to each other and to coordinate their activities. But yes, pretty much each individual node looks like something most of us are familiar with.
There were supposed to be, from some of the early materials I had seen, some new types of chips used in Blue Waters. Are they still new? Was that something that was specific when IBM was working on the project, since I know you've switched then from IBM to Cray?
Yeah, so the original IBM project grew out of a DARPA research program called High Productivity Computing Systems. And as part of that, they were developing two new chips. One was the Power7 chip, which was the next generation in IBM's line of processing chips. So this is the line that they put into servers. But the most exciting part of that machine was the other chip, which was this interconnect chip, the very piece that I said really distinguishes these supercomputers. And that interconnect had some really remarkable abilities. And when we had to switch to Cray, we had to switch to a system where the processor was different. So now instead of the Power7, we have an AMD Interlago. So that's what's interesting maybe about that is that's a Intel-style architecture just like runs on your laptop. And then the interconnect, they had their own chip, which implements what they call the Gemini network, which provides, again, very high performance, although in a different way in some ways to what IBM had. And so we've had to deal with the differences in the system. But it's those, particularly the interconnect chips, that distinguish the system.
Okay, so they don't sound quite as sexy as the new IBM chips, but they at least get the job done, I take it.
They're very good. They do get the job done. When we had to make the change, it was not an automatic change. We had to convince the National Science Foundation that our system in the new configuration would still meet the needs of the scientists that were going to use it. And that required showing that the system could achieve the scientific ends. There are, in fact, some parts of the system which I would say are sexier than in the IBM system. So about 3,000 of the racks, or 3,000 of the nodes, rather, are equipped with these graphics processing units. These graphics processing units are able to do much more computing per unit energy, the amount of effort, and per time than what we were going to get from IBM. But there are some trade-offs. They're somewhat harder to use. Not all the applications can make use of them. They're quite exciting for people. And one of the interesting things about those chips is that what we found is students are very interested in learning how to make use of those. So when we have workshops to teach people how to program these, we tend to have to turn people away because we run out of room.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with Bill Gropp with the U of I's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies, as well as the university's Parallel Computing Institute, about petascale supercomputers, especially the new Blue Waters supercomputer here at the Urbana campus. If you have questions or comments, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can also send them to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. And one question coming in, what are the chances that someone could hack blue waters. Is hacking a concern with computers like this?
Absolutely. So hacking is a very serious concern, particularly because this machine is available to scientists across the country. So it's
online.
It's online.
It's hooked up to the internet.
It's on the internet.
And that you can send commands to this computer if you know the right protocols.
That's right. So cybersecurity has been a very serious issue from the beginning. We have a fairly sophisticated system for authenticating users, for making sure that only the people who have been granted access to the machine can get access to it. For example, you need more than a password to get in to the machine when you try to log in. We have a system for cybersecurity that is constantly watching the traffic in and out of the machine to look for patterns that are representative of being hacked. There are a number of other things. Of course, I can't give you all the details, but it is a very serious issue and one that we have put a fair amount of effort into ensuring that the system, I hate to say, can't be hacked, but we made it as difficult as possible.
Is there any evidence that anybody has tried?
There's always attacks on new systems. No one has gotten, as far as I know, past the first barrier.
Okay. So far the defenses are holding.
Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit going back to the fact that Blue Water started as an IBM project with the U of I and the National Science Foundation, and now is a Cray project. And I always assumed, I didn't know for sure, that the blue and blue waters referred at least in part to IBM's corporate color and their nickname Big Blue. But IBM withdrew from the project. Nobody pushed them out, I take it. They withdrew on their own?
That's correct.
And, I guess you could interpret it different ways. It made it sound like it was awfully hard. Was it simply a matter that it was more difficult and required more resources than the company was ready to put into the project at that time than they had thought going in, or that they had real development problems in putting the project together?
At the end, I think it really was that it was going to take more resources than they expected. We were able to do a joint press release, and you can interpret press releases the way you want. Any way you want, but we did do a joint press release, and that press release is pretty accurate as to the real reason. It was going to cost IBM more than they had originally expected, and they had decided that they were unwilling to accept that cost, and there was a way for them to get out of the project cleanly in a way that allowed us to go on to a different vendor and allowed them to not absorb the cost that they would have had to bear.
How then, once the university and the NSF, once you're in that position, how do you shop around for another supercomputer builder?
Well, you have to ask for people to, I shouldn't say bid, but you need to look at what your best options are. You need to give people an opportunity to make suggestions. We had to see if there was, for example, someone that we didn't know about that had the right technology. So we effectively interviewed a number of suppliers that believed that they could meet the original requirements. And then we had to do a technical evaluation of what they proposed, whether, in fact, it would meet the requirements, whether they had the experience to deliver a system this large. In fact, no one has experience with a system this large. Our machine is the largest machine that Cray has ever delivered, but it's not that much bigger than ones that they had delivered. If you're looking at somebody who's saying, well, we could do this, but it'll be 50 times bigger than anything we've done, you have to keep that in mind. But we went through this process and identified Cray as being able to meet the requirements for the science users that we wanted to, that we needed to supply to provide for to meet the National Science Foundation's needs.
And it should be noted that Cray is certainly a venerable name as far as that goes in computers. And as far as I could tell, the first machine that's identified as being the first supercomputer in 1964 was developed by, I guess, Robert Cray, the namesake for the company.
Seymour Cray.
Seymour Cray. I don't know who Robert Cray is, unless there's more than one. Seymour Cray would have been the person. Is he still with the company?
No, he died some years ago.
Okay.
Most unfortunate.
But the company has continued on. And when it came to that part about financial burden, is the Cray Company taking a similar burden, or was a different arrangement arrived at?
The arrangement for Cray, in some sense, may have been a little easier because we could not accept any further delay in the delivery of the system. So when the original system, proposal was accepted, IBM was still developing the product. So there were things that they didn't know about how much it was going to cost to deliver. Because the award was made in 2007, early 2008. And so as time went on, they discovered that things were going to cost more than they expected. When we went to Cray, we were now looking at an established product or something very close in their product line. So they had a better sense for their overall costs. Now, the total amount available hadn't changed. So we had to deliver as powerful a system for the same amount that the National Science Foundation had authorized for it. But it was a little easier for Cray at the time. And things had changed since the original bid. So there was some new technology, these graphics processing units in particular, that weren't available in 2006 when the original bids were happening.
Okay. And by the way, I've just checked, Robert Cray is a blues guitarist.
Ah!
Still living, probably not a close relative. Let's go ahead and take a call now, and we have and Bill, if you would put your headphones on, then we can both talk to line one. Paul in Champaign County, you're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, and he did a great show in Springfield just last fall too. So, but I wanted to ask you what kind of stuff is being done on this. This is all very interesting, and I'm still curious about the how you say it's hard to rate supercomputers differently. These days, and I'm concerned. I know there is a Cray DoD computer in the same facility, and I've always been worried about SAIC and whether they might have some sub rosa connection and be able to do some of their Operation Stockpile or Project Deep Green. I think that's a code for it. Battle Shield Management software. And that kind of thing. I've been told in the past when somebody was on that all the time is carefully allocated and we know what's going on. But I think under the cover of downtime and moment-to-moment downtime that some national security stuff could be done. So I'm curious on a bunch of different levels, and I guess I probably should hang up and let somebody else have a turn here too. I appreciate the opportunity. Deal with some of that. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Well, let's the question at hand is I don't know if you would tell us. Is there any secret Defense Department work being done at this computer? Is it strictly academic work that is for the sake of research and would eventually become public?
So I can say that, yes, it is strictly academic research work. One of the reasons I feel very comfortable in saying that is that when I was a graduate student, I worked at Lawrence Livermore, which does do defense work. And there's a difference in how you operate systems for defense work and non-defense work. And even though our system has very good cybersecurity to prevent it from being hacked, we're not operating it with the kinds of restrictions that are necessary for defense work. And then I also say, I mean, I can watch what's going on the machine at all times. And I recognize all of the groups that are computing on it. And there's just a huge amount of basic science going on the system at all times. And maybe the last thing to say is that the machine, for example, that I mentioned, the Sequoia at Lawrence Livermore, that has 1.5 million cores, that is a defense machine. And so there are very large supercomputers available for defense work. There is, in some sense, no need to take the risk of using our system to do that.
Well, that brings us back to the question of what sort of problems, besides we know that they're big and complex, what sort of problems require a petascale supercomputer? What can we talk to any degree about what these problems or questions look like?
Sure. There's a huge range, and we can start at the biggest size, and I'll go down to the very smallest. So one question, for example, that astronomers have is, how did the universe come to look the way it does? Why do galaxies look the way they do? Why are they distributed the way they are? This is a very difficult problem to answer, and we don't know how to answer it by doing just mathematical analysis. What we can do is come up with the equations that describe how stars and maybe dark matter and molecular clouds interact. But having those rules doesn't tell us what the universe would look like just by looking at the rules. We have to apply the rules to what is essentially a model universe and see how it evolves in time. And that means looking at billions of interacting particles, and the particles may be stars, they may be clusters, they may be large clouds, and following how they develop over billions of years in time, that requires a big supercomputer because a lot of what controls the evolution is gravity, and gravity is forever. Every part of the universe has some influence on the rest of it. It becomes smaller as you go farther and farther away, but it doesn't go away. And so computer scientists and computational scientists develop efficient ways to represent this, but you still need a big computer to follow what's going on and to really understand how galaxies form and shape the way they are now, and to understand how they're distributing the universe, you have to do these calculations. And astronomers are faced with a real problem as a science, because in many cases we say in science, well, you form a hypothesis and then you conduct an experiment. So how does an astronomer conduct an experiment? It's not like they can build their own galaxy.
But in a sense, they can by using these mathematical models, they can, if you can get a computer with the right capacity to contain the universe in it.
Exactly. So with Blue Waters, they can conduct these experiments to see if their theories work.
And I guess it sounds like a lot of problems that a big supercomputer might take on would involve questions in which there are an incredible amount of elements which look random but may not be.
Yes.
So besides astronomy, what else is out there?
Well, so as we move down in scale, you can look at space weather is an example of something that we're looking at.
Space weather means not atmospheric weather on a planet,
right.
but there in space where there's still some weather, even though
it's there are gases that are blown off of the sun that interact with the magnetic fields around the Earth, for example. This can impact, for example, communication satellites, our ability to make use of those satellites for GPS signals, for communications, you know, for direct satellite. So understanding that's important. Understanding earthquakes. So trying to simulate how an earthquake might affect the Los Angeles basin is something, again, where you're trying to understand if an earthquake happens, where are the effects going to be most severe. From that, you might then change your building codes or your emergency management plans to relate to that. at smaller, continuing smaller scales, and try to understand turbulent fluid flow, which is important for lots of engineering, anything from engines, flight, and even designing air conditioning systems. There's a lot of work that's going on at the biological level in molecular dynamics. So understanding weaknesses in HIV, which is some work that has been going on here by Clef Shulton, work understanding fundamental chemistry. And as we get down to one of the projects is trying to understand what's called the standard model of physics, which is the basic model for elementary particles.
One of those life, the universe, and everything sort of questions.
Right. So we go all the way from elementary particles up to the entire universe.
Okay. And there's the capacity for that in Blue Waters?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Let's take one more call before we go to the break, and that's line one. David in Champaign, hello, you're on Focus.
Hi. I was just wondering, the system XSEED, which I understand is a bunch of computers all over the country, and I have time on a computer called Longhorn in Texas, and I wondered if Blue Waters was going to be tied into that.
Okay. That's an interesting question. Maybe for the other listeners, XSEED is a system of computers, sort of a virtual organization of computers, also managed by the National Science Foundation. In fact, the XSEED management is also done here at Illinois through the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And there are a number of machines, and I will call them supercomputers, although they are not as powerful as Blue Waters, in some cases maybe less than one-tenth as powerful, but still very powerful machines. And the question is, will these separate organizations be working together? And the answer is sort of we talk to each other. There's definite desire to help people move from the resources that they have on XSEED to maybe the resources on Blue Waters. One of the things that's different is the XSEED system is meant to provide computational resources for a large number of research groups. It's sort of a combination of what we call capability and capacity. So capability is the ability to do really big problems, but the capacity is being able to serve the many users that need the machine. Blue Waters is a very expensive resource. You should sort of think of it as something equivalent to a big space telescope or a huge accelerator. It's a capability system that is serving a small number of groups. So not very many people need a machine as big as Blue Waters. For those that do, there's a process to get time on it. And we are coordinating with XSEED about this. And in fact, in many cases, people who want to use Blue Waters may first make use of the XSEED resources to tune up their understanding of their application, make sure that it can run fast on the XSEED scale machines before demonstrating that they need something more powerful.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, David. And let's go ahead and take a break now. We'll be back in a moment with more about supercomputers with Bill Gropp. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're back on Focus on WYLL with Bill Gropp to talk about supercomputers, in particular the one at the U of I. Bill is Deputy Director for Research at the U of I's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies, and he's worked extensively on Blue Waters. You can call us with your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580, and the phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. We did have a follow-up question on the hacking issue, which was essentially we were talking about whether or not Blue Waters could be hacked. But, of course, the logical question after that, if Blue Waters were hacked,
what would happen? Is there a lot of sensitive data? Would people's experiments be ruined? What could happen?
That's also a very good question. So a lot of what is going on Blue Waters are what we call simulations. So the applications are taking a theory about how things happen, how galaxies form, or how a molecule might conform when you put it in a solution. And you apply the mathematical rules to simulate this and see what happens, and you save data about it. So we're not doing real-time control of experiments. We're not doing anything that would necessarily expose proprietary data. We may, in the future, be having some businesses making some use of the system. There is a mechanism for us to allow certain kinds of research use of the computing. So there might be some data that would be considered sensitive. It's one of the reasons why it's so important to be careful about this. But most of what's going on in the machine is really basic research. And so what hacking would do for the machine is primarily cost us time, because we would have to clean out what had been done before resuming operation.
Okay. It wouldn't be like some research would be ruined that you couldn't get back?
Primarily not. Most of the data comes from places where it was stored elsewhere. Again, a lot of it's not sort of real-time processing of data, at least not right now.
So a lot of precautions in there to I don't know if fail-safes is the right word or not, but it's like you're saving all the time.
Yes, yeah.
Another question just came in by email. Will Blue Waters be available to the private sector partners through the university's National Center for Supercomputing Applications?
Yes, and that's really what I meant about some commercial access. The National Science Foundation, in recognition of the contributions from both the state and the university to, for example, the building and some of the staff support as we were getting ready, will allow us to sell on a cost recovery basis. So we won't make any money on this, but we won't lose any either, to members of the private sector program that have applications that make sense for Blue Waters.
Okay. And I'm just going to bring up there is a website for it. You probably know the address by heart if you want to tell people about it. But the one thing that struck me at the Blue Waters website, which is ncsa.illinois.edu/bluewaters, is that you can apply right here. I suspect it's a complicated process, but you can apply to use the computer.
Yes. So there is a mechanism by which university faculty can apply for time on the system. There's a requirement for a proposal. We have to explain why this machine and not, for example, the resources of Exceed or a smaller system, why the application is interesting and worth the level of effort it would take to make use of it. And you also have to understand how much time you need. Computers, it's easy to think of computers as infinitely fast because they are so fast. But when you're looking at solving a problem on a machine like this, you have to have some way to estimate how much of time you're really going to need, because some problems are still so hard that even a machine as powerful as Blue Waters may be thousands of times too slow for a problem, or maybe 1,000 times too fast. So you have to be able to tell us that. And then there is a process. In fact, we are in the midst of doing the reviews for the first round of these applications. In fact, I have a meeting later today to go through them. And as is true with most of these computers, there are far more people who want time than there is time available. So if there was enough research funding to build another Blue Waters, we could also fill it up with good science. So one of the difficult challenges as we go forward is trying to find the best way to allocate the time amongst all of the people who want to make use of it.
Well, I'm looking at the website here, and in the applications section, apparently, if you get time on Blue Waters, what you have is a PRAC, a petascale computing resource allocation, and there's a list of some of the ones that have been granted so far, and they're just very tantalizing names of the things you're doing here. Accelerating nanoscale transistor innovation are ab initio models. Ab initio is Latin, but I don't know what for. Models of solar activity. Breakthrough petascale quantum Monte Carlo calculate. Monte Carlo?
Yes.
Well, that refers to what?
It's a method for solving problems that is based on certain random choices.
Okay.
So that's why it's called Monte Carlo.
Okay, principle of chances there. Computational relativity and gravitation at petascale, simulating and visualizing astrophysically realistic compact binaries. I will surrender with that one, but it does sound like it's dealing with astronomy. And there's about 30 of these out here that you've already granted. They haven't necessarily started, but they have a space in the computer.
Right. So the PRACs are the projects that are allocated by the National Science Foundation.
PRAC. Okay, so, not PRAC. Okay.
And the National Science Foundation has chosen those, and there are a little over 30 of these projects. Some of them are already running on the machine now. Most of these will have significant allocations of time, so significant as in hundreds of thousands of node hours to do their science. And these projects typically last a couple of years. And over the life of the machine, which is about 5 years, the National Science Foundation will continue to select a small number of additional projects. And I do use this word project because each of these projects is a science project that involves numbers of investigators, numbers of students. And so the total number of users is much greater than just these 30 projects. And this is typical for a large-scale scientific facility.
And when somebody wants to know something, it's more like a lot of people want to know something.
Yes.
Let's go to a phone call. Let's go to line one and Eric in Urbana. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, Bill. It's Eric Jacobson, actually. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about something that I would see coming in the future. And it's kind of the mirror image of the project you talked about. And this is unraveling the roots of many, many, many diseases from human genome sequence information. So the software is not quite there yet for petascale applications, and really the data organization isn't there. But in sequence-based bioinformatics, we kind of do the inverse problem where we, instead of in the simulations you described, where you know the rules and you compute the consequences of following those rules, in informatics, you have this enormous amount of data, and the data flood is increasing because the sequencing machines are much faster, and what you have to do is do correlations on the data to go back and figure out from that, those correlations, the rules that connect the phenotype, for example, a disease phenotype or a normal behavior phenotype, for that matter, to the gene combinations that will influence those. So that's not quite there yet, but I would see that in the next decade or so becoming a really major application of petascale and computing.
Yes, Eric, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when we talk about supercomputers, there is a tendency to focus on the compute part, the number of operations that we can do. But one of the things that is remarkable about Blue Waters, and one of the things that sets it apart from most of the other supercomputers, is its ability to handle data, in the possibility to look for these correlations. So to give everyone an idea of the scale, the total amount of memory in which you can quickly work on the machine is about 1.5 petabytes. So that's 1.5 million billion characters of data. And I'm not talking about like the space that you have on your disk, which a big disk on a laptop is a terabyte or 1/1000th of a petabyte. This is the amount of information that we can put into the machine's working memory at one time. And one of the things that is missing currently from the list of applications, but I have been encouraging people to think about it, is an application where you want to look at that much data. You want to be able to search through it without knowing what you're looking for yet, because, as you say, we don't really know all of these rules yet, and we need to start looking for them and trying to discover them. So I think that in the next couple of years, I hope to see what we call sort of more data-intensive, data-centric applications that will take advantage of the unique ability of this machine to process, not just do floating-point computations and multiplications and additions, but to look at data.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll see that.
I'm looking forward to it.
Eric, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, I was wondering how much, if you're a team with a PRAC, how much are you paying to use Blue Waters?
So you're not paying anything. You're given a grant by the National Science Foundation, which is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars of time, just as if you get a research grant that pays for, you know, time of your graduate students or your other supplies. One of the things that's a little weird about this is that it is a very valuable resource, and you get this big grant of time, but because you're given this grant of time instead of a dollar figure, a lot of people lose touch with just how valuable this resource is.
That's something to remember, but it's not something, as one question that came in over email was asking, like, this is not a money making service for the university or even for the National Science Foundation.
No, this machine was provided by the National Science Foundation so that researchers, many of whom are funded by the National Science Foundation, have the computing power that they need in order to conduct their research.
One thing that Blue Waters does do is use a lot of energy, and we had a question about that. And I think in the TED Talk that I had watched of yours online, you talked about how one thing that computers, as they get more powerful, is that they give off a lot of heat.
Yes.
I think surface of the sun was the comparison you made. I don't know if that's literally true or not.
Yeah, so when you look at the energy density, so the amount of heat per unit area, a computer chip is very, very hot. So surface of the sun was, we're getting close to those levels of heat density. So the total amount of energy wasn't huge, although it was like a couple of hundred watts, so a very bright light bulb. But it was concentrated in a very small amount of space, and you have to pull that heat off to keep the chip from being damaged.
One of the reasons it's called Blue Waters is that you're using a water cooling system to keep everything from overheating. Is that correct?
That is part of it. So the original IBM system was really water cooled in the sense that water piping, chilled water went through the entire pieces of equipment, direct conduction with water chiller pipes. I like to call what we have now a water-assisted air-cooled system. So this is blows cold air over the components, but there is chilled water in each of those racks. So we run water through the whole machine. It is cold water. And during much of the year, we can get that cold water by exchanging heat with the air at the top of the building.
Okay, so the most energy-efficient ways possible, but you're using a lot of energy on this computer. And how much of it is just for the cooling, and how much of it is for running the computer otherwise?
So most of it is, in fact, for running the computer. There is a measure of the power efficiency of a computing center called the PUE, so it's power utilization efficiency, I believe. That measures sort of the power for the computer inverse divided by the total amount of power that goes into the building to do things like the cooling and lights and everything else. And our power efficiency is between 1.1 and 1.2. So that means that almost all of the power is going into the computer, and around 10% or so for cooling.
Okay. I have so many more questions here. And the problem is we are out of time. This has been a fascinating hour talking about Blue Waters, the supercomputer at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. And you can look at their website. Just Google Blue Waters supercomputer and you will come across it. Bill Grump is Deputy Director for Research at the U of I's Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies. And I want to say thank you, Bill. You're also the director of the Parallel Computing Institute at the U of I. The website is ncsa.illinois.edu/bluewaters. Bill, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Jim.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program. Just go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result in your search engine under WILL Focus. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. And you can also hear us streamed at will.illinois.edu. And that's where you can also go to listen to years of past programs in our archives. Tomorrow on Focus, two guests will talk about their work helping women in developing regions of the world, in Islamic countries and in Cambodia. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Jim Meadows.